to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where ordinarily we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for an hour, but this time we're making an exception, and we're going to be talking about Watchmen for the entire episode. And it's not just the theatrical cut or even the director's cut. We're actually going to be talking about the, you know, for what it matters, we're going to be talking about the ultimate cut, quote unquote, which has scenes interspliced from their animated scenes. It's the director's cut plus animated scenes of Tales of the Black Freighter, which in the original graphic novel was a comic within a comic about the adventures of a sea captain who is shipwrecked and then gradually makes his way back to his town while succumbing to madness, basically. And it was sort of done to indicate that in a world where superheroes actually existed, comic books would not be about superheroes. They would be about something else. And in the case of Watchmen, it would be about pirates. And And the events in the story that you sort of dip in and out of throughout are they somewhat parallel the events of what's going on in the comic, although the storyline of Tales of the Black Freighter is so despondent that it kind of parallels, you know, all the despondency, no matter what kind of despondency is going on in the story of Watchmen. But they released like a separate DVD to bilk some more money out of the fanboys of the animated scenes, and they just called it Tales of Black Freighter, but we watched the ultimate cut with the scenes interspliced, I guess, more or less where the comic within a comic would have shown up in the actual Watchmen comic. And I don't know about you, but unfortunately I don't have a copy of Watchmen laying around handy to compare the movie to, but I mean, I think I remember it fairly well enough to do some comparisons. But before we get into all that, we thought we might preface with not only Alan Moore's comments on the Watchmen movie before it came out, and there's no point in going to his comments after the movie came out because he didn't see it anyways, and then Roger Ebert's thoughts on the film in his Chicago Sun-Times review. So I was looking at, I remember reading this before, Alan Moore, before the film came out, Alan Moore did a interview on the phone with the LA Times, and he had some pretty choice quotes. I'm going to read a couple of them here. First of all, I find film in its modern form to be quite bullying. It spoon-feeds us, which has the effect of watering down our collective cultural imagination. It is as if we are freshly hatched birds looking up with our mouths open, waiting for Hollywood to feed us more regurgitated worms. The Watchmen film sounds like more regurgitated worms. I, for one, am sick of worms. Can't we get something else? Perhaps some takeout? Even Chinese worms would be a nice change. He goes on to say, there are three or four companies now that exist for the sole purpose of creating not comics, but storyboards for films. It may be true that the only reason the comic book industry now exists is for the purpose to create characters for movies, board games, and other types of merchandise. Comics are just sort of a pumpkin patch growing franchises that might be profitable for the ailing movie industry. He goes on to say, well, it's not directly to Watchmen, but this is interesting. He's talking of Will Eisner's The Spirit and the sort of filmatic approach that Will Eisner had had to his comics, even in the 1940s. As much as I admire Eisner, I think maintaining that approach in recent history has done more harm than good. If you approach comics as a poor relation to film, you are left with a movie that does not move, has no soundtrack, and lacks the benefit of having a recognizable movie star in the lead role. He goes on to say, and I think this will be the last quotation, LA Times writer writes, he also said he was offended by the amount of money and resources that go into the Hollywood projects. Alan Moore then says, quote, they take an idea, balderize it, blow it up, make it infantile, and spend $100 million to give people a brief escape from their boring and often demeaning lives at work. It's obscene and it's offensive. This is not the culture I signed up for. I'm sure I sound like Bobby Fischer talking about chess. So I think that about covers it. And you were reading Roger Ebert's review, and you mentioned that you, parts of it indicate to you that he didn't even see the movie.
Yeah, and actually there was one more Alan Moore quote. If I can find it, I would like to read it. Just because it's so funny, and sort of shows you how little the people understand it, the filmmakers understand it.
Could it have been an interview in reference to one of his other works that it's that's been adapted into a crappy movie?
No, actually, here it's really funny. Zack Snyder was being interviewed at reelschannel.com about Alan Moore's dismissal of the movie, and Snyder said, "Worst case scenario, Alan puts the movie on his DVD player on a cold Sunday in London and watches and says, 'Yeah, that doesn't suck too bad.'" Well, someone later asked Moore about it, and he said, "That's the worst case scenario. I think he's underestimated what the worst case scenario would be. That's never going to be in my DVD player in London." And the parenthetical is, Moore very famously lives in Northampton, to the point that his novel is about Northampton over the last 5,000 years or something. He's like, "I'm never going to watch this fucking thing." However, Snyder still says his ultimate hope is that someday Moore will see the film and think it's a decent representation. And I think that Alan Moore gets that Zack Snyder using words like worst case scenario and ultimate hope. I mean, you know, he doesn't even know what these words mean. He's talking about a movie. He's talking about a stupid movie that, you know. So it's, I think Alan Moore is kind of aware that, well, obviously, I mean, Snyder's, some of the changes to the more, but we'll get to that in a bit. So here's here's some Roger Ebert stuff. I'm picking and choosing here. And I'll read the first line. "After the revelation of The Dark Knight, here is Watchmen, another bold exercise in the liberation of the superhero movie." Yes, that superhero movie that needs liberating. Let's see, I'm going down. Oh, jeez. He refers to the characters as masked warriors at one point, which is just really embarrassing because, I mean, Ebert writes for a newspaper. It's not like he's doing a commercial, you know, a promotional commercial on Reels Screen or whatever, reelschannel.com. He even has a rhetorical question. Oh, God. Okay, this is the paragraph that I like the most that sort of suggested to me that he hasn't read anything. "Dr. Manhattan, the only one with superpowers in the literal sense, lives outside ordinary time and space, the forces of the universe seeming to coil beneath his skin." That doesn't really say anything to me to describe anything. But that's not, I mean, that he could, that sort of comes from the press release. Next is, "Ozymandias is the world's smartest man." Okay, that's very interesting. Here we go. "The Night Owl is a man isolated from life by his mastery of technology." Well, that's not actually true at all. That's not what his problem is. His problem is he's dejected and depressed because he's not a superhero anymore. It has nothing to do with his mastery of technology. That's never even an issue in the entire freaking movie. Rorschach is a man who finds meaning in patterns that may only exist in his mind. That's not true at all either.
No.
Nope. Okay, and this is my favorite because just I'm reading this verbatim, this one here. "And Silk Spectre 2, Roman numeral 2, because, you know, that's how they refer to her in the freaking movie and not in the press kit, lives with one of the most familiar human challenges, living up to her parents, in this case, the original Silk Spectre." That's not true either. Her problem is that she doesn't know her who her father is, basically, and she's tormented by, you know, some sort of repressed memories, and she's living with a psychopathic superhero, or whatever, a disconnected superhero. So that was one of the things that I was just kind of like, he didn't really read this, or he didn't really see this, did he? I mean, it seems like, because some of those things, I mean, Night Owl and Rorschach are the two biggest male characters in the movie, and he doesn't seem to know what the heck's going on with either of them.
Yeah.
Now, hold on. There's one other thing here about... Oh, this is what I like the most. Okay, where is it? Dr. Manhattan. Okay, Dr. Manhattan possessing access to the blah, blah, blah. In the film's most spectacular scene, he is exiled to Mars. That never happens. He's not exiled to Mars. He goes to Mars when he's sick of everyone else. And in utter isolation, reimagines himself as a human.
Huh?
Okay, hold on. And conjures, or discovers, I'm not sure, an incredible city seemingly made of crystal and mathematical concepts. Okay. This sequence in the film is actually probably the film's only successful sequence because it's got the Philip Glass music, and it's a really strong sort of episode from the comic where it's all about Dr. Manhattan's father being a watchmaker, and so he makes a huge watch as his city. He makes it intentionally, thinking about it during this sequence. He does not transform himself into a human. If he were to do that, there would be a human on Mars. There's not. There's just Dr. Manhattan. And I'm just reading this going, did Ebert fall asleep during this? I mean, and then he also says, that level of symbol, this is a little bit earlier, that level of symbolism is coiling away beneath all the superheroes. That's the second time he uses coil. And I wonder if he, like, came across it as his word of the day and decided to use it in an attempt to win another Pulitzer. I mean, he's just... Oh, jeez. Okay, hold on. Oh, this is even better. This is his conclusion. The film is rich enough to be seen more than once. I plan to see it again, this time on IMAX, and we'll have more to say about it. I don't believe he ever wrote a second review of it. So.
Yeah, he didn't Twitter about it later, unfortunately.
I am not sure I understood all the nuances and implications. Okay, the idea that a Zack Snyder movie has nuances and implications. I don't even think Zack Snyder would say that because I don't think he knows what the word nuance means. And implications, I think he would think was some sort of, I don't know, what, some scandal thing, political scandal thing, the implications. Yeah. He'd think it was something like that.
Yeah.
Now, continuing for Ebert. But I am sure I had a powerful experience. I had a powerful experience, too, of revulsion and, you know, just sort of wanting to tie Snyder to the back of a truck and drag him for the way he turned the World Trade Center into whatever, pornography or something. But anyway, it's not as entertaining as The Dark Knight. Okay, so I was unaware The Dark Knight was supposed to be entertaining. I thought it was supposed to be a, you know, maudlin trip through the depths of the human condition. But that's sort of what Gary Oldman's awesome speech at the end's all about. But like the Matrix films, LOTR, which, not having seen any of the Lord of the Rings movies or care about them at all, I always have to pause at that and look at it and think about the fact that this guy's a professional journalist.
Yeah, he must be spending a lot more time on the internet lately if he's referring to
it. And The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
So he just said that it's not like The Dark Knight, but it is like The Dark Knight. It's going to inspire fevered analysis. Who analyzed The Dark Knight, the Matrix films, the Lord of the Rings films, or I'm sorry, The Dark Knight again? No one.
Well, nerds, but...
I mean, not in any sense that Roger Ebert would ever encounter any of these analyses.
Yeah.
So, and then his final statement is, I don't want to see it twice for that reason, however, but mostly just to have the experience again.
Wow.
So, and now the movie opens with this obscene in terms of the graphic novel. And I do remember some things because I think I read the graphic novel... I'm sorry, what am I saying? I read the comic book in between. Alan Moore would definitely not want us to refer to Watchmen as a graphic novel.
Okay, agreed. We won't do
okay.
that.
I read the comic in between the last time I saw it and this time I saw it.
Yeah.
So there are certain things that they sort of cheat at. Well, obviously there's no giant monster at the end of the movie.
Right.
Instead, they're going to demonize Dr. Manhattan and something and something. Now, what's really interesting is, and you mentioned this when you first saw it, is that they turn it into this whole thing about free energy.
It's got a lot of what Rorschach called shallow liberal affectations.
And I was confused, and I think I'd forgotten about it in the comic. Dr. Manhattan, before the start of the story in the regular Watchmen series, has already done that.
Wow,
everyone has
that.
Free energy. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things he's done. And instead, in the movie, they turn it into one of the things that they're going to do after he's gone.
Yeah, because, you know, green technology and other trendy memes.
And so it's kind of like so they've removed this sort of plot point in establishing the Watchmen story, gone ahead and adapted it, not word for word or anything, but sort of as faithfully as...
There's a kind of... Well, I mean, Zack Snyder did this with 300. It's this kind of superficial faithfulness where you just copy the comics panels and then, you know, elevate yourself above criticism for any other creative license you might have had because you copied the panels for your storyboards.
Yeah, and so it's kind of like... But by turning something that should have already happened into one of the major developments and one of the reasons for killing Rorschach and doing all this stuff at the end, it's sort of in... It's like they didn't think of it. They didn't realize what they were doing, or... It's like they didn't... Because they change a great deal of it. And,
I think it's a bit of a mistake and a bit of a trap to get too into the details of what was changed from the comic. Because, I mean, Zack Snyder's MO for this movie and the MO of Ain't It Cool News readers hoping for this film to be a success so that their little niche interest of comic books can be legitimized by the mainstream is the idea that if only a faithful adaptation were made of this great comic book, then, you know, people who don't read comic books will understand. And that was the hope they had with, you know, if you just make a serious and gritty enough Batman movie, people will realize how great Batman is. Again, but you know, for the right reasons. That's a mistake because he superficially copied the, you know, costumes. I remember when photos of the costumes started showing up and it was like, oh, great, Rorschach looks the same, only, well, certain details. But he was like, oh, great, you know, the costumes look enough like the comic books. We can declare this thing a success. And it's kind of like there's this... It doesn't, you know, none of that has any... My point is none of that has anything to do with making a good movie or even a movie which, like, has any consideration of the points of the original work upon which it's, I want to say based, but based is almost, like, too much of a compliment. It's, like, stolen.
I think that's it, though. I think that's what I'm trying to say is that they totally miss the point of the overall... By turning it into something about whatever, green energy, they're totally missing the point of the initial work.
Not that it's about that, it's just that it's about nothing.
Well, they kill Lee Iacocca because he's not on board. I mean, there's all that shit. And it's just kind of like...
Yeah, well, I mean, that is just one scene, but sort of what really annoyed me about that is that the original scene, it's like, those guys aren't, you know, the executives of, you know, ExxonMobil or anything. They're like, you know, Ozymandias's cronies, and they're talking about the new line of perfume that he's putting out or something like that, you know.
And they sort of completely miss that aspect of him, and...
Despite, you know, showing that, yeah, he made action figures based off of himself and the former Watchmen. Yeah, they did miss it completely.
Of course, let's not forget that in the comic, they're never called the Watchmen. They don't have superhero team name.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. If anything, they were called the Minutemen. In fact, I wonder if they changed that in the movie at some point, because they're like stills of the Minutemen.
Right.
Where identifies them as the Minutemen, and then later on in the dialogue they refer to them as the first team of Watchmen or whatever. And right. It's well, I mean, if you call the team the Watchmen, then you totally lose the
idea that there was some really, you know, literate and well educated guy in the streets of New York spray painting who watches the Watchmen.
Well, also that, but also the connotations of the Doomsday Clock being the watch in question, which then turns Watchmen into everyone.
Well, it's
not
like Zack,
specifically Zack, these guys.
You know, Zack Snyder and the two screenwriters like did have some vague awareness. It's like they've got some vague awareness of the themes that went into the original work, but they don't bother thinking about them. They're like, okay, it's a postmodern story about superheroes, so, you know, yeah, let's have them refer to themselves as superheroes and stuff, and yeah, it's about nuclear war, so, and it's about, you know, watches, so let's have shots of watches and stuff, and it's about, you know, an alternate history, so let's really amplify the, you know, President Richard Nixon's role, just to keep reminding people that they're in an alternate timeline.
What I found so amusing about Nixon is, especially following Frost Nixon, where you had someone who was not made up to look like Nixon.
This guy looks even worse.
Instead, you know, sort of inhabited the idea of Nixon. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's terrible makeup. It doesn't look like him at all.
It's like a Saturday Night Live sketch makeup.
Yeah, and the guy's performance is terrible. The Kissinger, I guess, is a little bit better, like just a little. But I honestly don't think if you... Does Zack Snyder know what Richard Nixon looks like? I mean, has he ever seen him speak? Did they sit down and watch anything? Because it's not funny if it doesn't actually remind of Nixon. If it's a movie Nixon, and you've heard of Nixon, that's totally different. That's not the point. That's not why Moore did it. I mean, it's just like...
Yeah, that's not why Moore did it. And Nixon is like a featured player in the movie version. He's in like, I don't know, three panels in the original comic book.
Oh, yeah, no, they have the whole Doctor Strangelove scene where they're going to...
Yeah, they do a whole... Yeah, he does a whole Doctor Strangelove
he's
scene.
Gonna
it's like
destroy
world. He hasn't watched news footage or anything of Nixon, but he has seen Doctor Strangelove, so...
Or someone's told him about it.
Yeah.
Which you have to wonder. I mean, that's...
Speaking of the alternate timeline thing, I mean, the opening credits sequence, it's like... Obviously, the idea of the opening credits sequence is to bring you up to speed on what the last 40 years might have looked like if there were superheroes, and it shows you all this stupid... It shows you all these scenes from history that, like, you know, you learn from pop culture's version of history, like hippies putting flowers in guns, but in this version of history they shoot the hippies, and, you know, Andy Warhol does pictures of Night Owl, and none of this stuff was in the comic book. Neither was, like, here's another shallow liberal affectation piling onto JFK conspiracy theories by having the comedian be the guy who shot JFK. That certainly wasn't in the comic book. It's like moments from history that a dumb person would use to try to sound like they know anything about history, because it's just taken from the pop culture version of history, and that's it. Oh, and there's like, you know, finds a, you know, they do like a parody of that photo where Nixon meets Elvis. They replace the comedian with Elvis. Just crap like that. And it's like, that's one of the most annoying things about this movie is how it thinks it's smart because it, you know, it stole something from, and it really did stole. I'm using that word literally because Alan Moore didn't want this movie to be made. The only reason it got made is because DC owns it, not him. And Alan Moore even turned down a paycheck for this movie and said, give it to the artist, Dave Gibbons, because I don't, you know, I don't want this on my hands. I don't want any part of this, you know. So he's actually a true man of integrity. And it was, the stuff was stolen from him. If it had been up to him, well, heck, none of the movie versions of his work would have had shallow liberal affectations added to them, like the Wachowski brothers' version of V for Vendetta, where it's an allegory for the Bush years or whatever.
Yeah, and that's kind of the problem is that Moore, those, I mean, not to go off topic too much by mentioning V for Vendetta, but the Moore is an anarchist of the sort of non-American, trendy, goth sense, and so that was what V for Vendetta, the comic book, was about. It was an argument for anarchy, and by turning it into sort of a cross between 1984 and whatever
Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah, it. Well, I mean, that's the least of that movie's problems in some ways. I mean, just on a getting through it kind of way. But there just seems to be this, it's like you're making Watchmen and you're saying, okay, well, this is the best comic of all time, so let's turn it into a movie. But let's assume that our movie-going audience is too stupid to understand it, so let's dumb it down. But of course, in this case, that's not what really happened. What happened is that, you know, Zack Snyder's not a very bright guy, quite frankly. And you know, 300's one of your favorite comic books, whatever. So he's not a very bright guy, and he was on the top. He was on top of the world at that time, and he was able to make this movie. And
but it's not like it was his idea. I mean, famously, the idea for a Watchmen movie has been kicked around as far back as, like, Sam Hamm of Batman fame having a go at the screenplay back in the late 80s, and Terry Gilliam expressing interests back in the day.
And at that time, Moore was involved to some degree. He would meet
with there's actually an interview in the Comics Journal or some publication like that where he says, like, yeah, this guy who's writing the Batman movie is taking a stab at it, so, you know, I had a lunch with him. He seemed like a nice guy, you know.
Yeah, so
curious as to what they'll do.
One of these things.
That was before anyone had made movies out of his comics yet, so he hadn't given up hope yet.
And that was, you know, Moore's kind of famous for writing off business and personal relationships and actually sticking to it regardless of the financial. So, yeah, he gives up all of his money on his movies now. He doesn't even want DC to put his name on the cover of the books that he's done for them.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but there's no union there, so they can't do it. What I love about, like, the Watchmen credits, it's like, based on a DC graphic novel co-created by Dave Gibbons. And you're just like, well, who's the other creator? I'm wondering about that. And what I loved about this was, because when I wrote it up for, I did an Alan Moore movie adaptation special for the stop button. That's when I first watched this. The New York Times doesn't, in their little credit blurb, doesn't put Alan Moore in there. They just, you know, copy and paste and format from the press release. And I'm kind of like, okay, you guys, this isn't a case of the WGA saying he didn't do it. It's a case of someone saying that he doesn't want his name on it. You're not reprinting the credits on the movie. You're supposed to be giving a full you know, type thing of it. Even if they discuss Alan Moore in the freaking article, they don't put him in the credits because it doesn't match. And I'm just kind of... It's goofy. I don't really
understand the credits for this movie at all, because the dwarf actor that they hired to play Mr. Figure, the dwarf crime boss who's imprisoned with Rorschach and attempts to kill him and ends up getting killed himself, he's like played by a fairly famous dwarf actor. He was like Kramer's dwarf friend on Seinfeld, and he doesn't even get credited, amazingly enough. Did he refuse credit as well? Him and Alan Moore. That's just kind of inexplicable, as opposed to Alan Moore's willful removal of himself from the credits.
Well, I mean, and also in other ways, I mean, having him as the, well, that's actually one of the movie's best scenes, of course. But besides, I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that Moore intended, I'm guessing, I haven't read any analyses Ebert has of Watchmen, the comic book. Rorschach's a tragic character. I mean, he's a broken guy, and he was broken as a kid, and he's a broken adult. And so the movie, and in the comic, Rorschach's death scene is just really awful, because it really just is, you know, these two, whatever, the Rock and the two opposing forces thing. In the movie, it comes close, nearly. I mean, in the movie, it's poorly directed on the acting sense. Like, I think Jackie Earle Haley is certainly capable of doing it. I just don't think Zack Snyder knew what he was doing. And then he follows it up with a really lame cut to Patrick Wilson screaming that looks more like when Luke screams about Ben Kenobi dying in the first Star Wars. It's that whiny scream.
And that wasn't in the comic, of course, but also neither in the comic was the visual gag of Rorschach's bloody remains forming a Rorschach test pattern in the snow.
That was
the other thing that ruined that scene.
And but Rorschach's sort of adventure in prison, where he, you know, takes out the goons of Mickey from Seinfeld. I mean, that's a good scene, because it turns it into sort of, it's like a...
I gotta disagree, because this is one of the things that I just wanted to mention as a major point of contention with this movie. as violent as the scene is in the comic book, Zack Snyder doesn't know how to amplify anything except violence, which is why all the action scenes and violence scenes from a comic book are more action-packed and more disgustingly bloody and gory in the film version, including that scene in the prison where, instead of one goon merely having his throat slit, he now has his arms sawed off and the blood sprays all over the place.
True. I was thinking more after that, when he does get into the prison cell and Rorschach just knocks him on the ground. I thought the pacing of that scene was okay, even though it was intercut with the terrible rescue scene. And that's the other thing about this. In the comic, I'm pretty sure that Silk Spectre 2 and Night Owl 2... Ebert didn't refer to him as Night Owl 2. Uh-oh. Anyway.
Well, that's the press release's fault.
Yeah, I suppose so. Zack Snyder won't be inviting Ebert over for whatever.
Hot toddy or something?
Hot toddy with Alan Moore. Well, shockingly, Ebert didn't give an audio commentary for Watchmen. I was kind of hoping he would. That would be hilarious. Well, he did that once. He did that with Dark City.
He's done that with that, and he did one with Terry Zwigoff for Crumb also.
Yeah, so I mean, like, maybe...
And Citizen Kane, Natch, and, you know, you'd think he would have done one for Watchmen or The Dark Knight. Either of one could be the Citizen Kane of comic book movies, according to Ain't It Cool News.
So, Silk Spectre and Night Owl have these two action scenes, and they just kill these guys.
It's really bloody,
breaking bones, stabbing them in the neck.
Killing guys.
Just killing them.
Killing people where they didn't kill them in the comic book. Jeez.
And so the best part is when the scene ends, like all the guys on the ground start moving like, oh, I'm so hurt. And you're just kind of like, you're dead because they stabbed you in the throat with a piece of glass. And it's just like, it reduces, I mean, they don't seem like superheroes anymore because they sit around and talk about how much they missed it. And I'm like, so what'd you guys do? You went out and killed people? Because then that puts them on the same level as the comedian who
killed... Rorschach, who's supposed to be the crazy ones.
Rorschach at least killed criminals versus the comedian who, you know, would kill the protesters. It's seriously implied he was killing people protesting them. And what I really love is for all the flashbacks, for all the crap of putting Carla Gugino and all that stupid freaking makeup, they never clearly explained what happened to the Watchmen that broke them up. They never clearly explained that, you know... Nixon introduced laws. They never say why he did.
There's one reference to the Keene Act, and like at no point does anybody even say, well, the Keene Act was the government order that outlawed superheroes.
And why did we do that? And it's just kind of like there's this whole thing with the police strike, and I remember in the comic it at least made sense. And
People like to rag on Sam Hamm in general because he wrote the first Batman and now that movie is heretical or something. But they also like to rag on him because you can read his Watchmen script on the internet. And you know what? It takes a lot of liberties and it makes some stuff pretty dumb. But the guy knows how to tell a story as opposed to like the people who made the Watchmen movie that eventually got made who, you know, make movies like they're, you know, archaeologists piecing together an ancient language or something. The guy knows how to tell a story, and he opens up the movie with a scene where, like, you know, Rorschach and Night Owl and all of them try to rescue some hostages from terrorists, and it goes wrong, and then he clearly says right at the start of the movie in the prologue, well, superheroes are outlawed now. That's your premise. And I mean, you know, when the comic book came out, it's sort of like, what was the one thing in the very first issue of the 12-issue, you know, miniseries that was going to grab you and keep reading? It was the premise that superheroes are real, A, and then B, they've become illegal. And yeah, Watchmen, the movie that eventually got made, managed to completely gloss over that hook.
And, I mean, you know, we're not doing two movies this episode. We're doing just one. And I don't think either of us are going to say that it's half a good movie.
I think at like 3 hours and 20 minutes, it becomes a rather infinitesimal fraction of a good movie.
We have to talk about that stupid cartoon in a bit if we can, but... Anyway, I just did want to say though that I mean, like I said earlier, the Dr. Manhattan scene on Mars, it's really cool. It's a pretty much a straight adaptation of it. Billy Crudup, you know, has the voice for narrating this silly adventure, or not an adventure, but this sequence.
Yep. I liked Rob LaBelle as the, you know, Jewy scientist sidekick of his.
Who apparently later got cancer and died, but we missed that part. That was the other thing, is I don't remember the comic, but one of the plot points is that anybody who knew Dr. Manhattan is getting cancer and dying.
Right, except if that was, as it's later supposed to be revealed, part of Ozymandias's conspiratorial machinations, then it makes no sense.
Except it also makes no sense because, what's his face? Wally Weaver, the Rob LaBelle character, he got cancer years ago.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
And Dr. Manhattan, it didn't dawn on him or anything. Dr. Manhattan can't look at the people's genetic makeup and know whether or not they really got cancer. And I mean, did they really give him cancer or not? That's the other thing. It's never clear, in my opinion. It's never clear if they really gave his ex-girlfriend cancer because she works there.
Yeah.
She was aware of them giving cancer to the bad guy. And in the comic, some of this also has to do with, you know, this is why the comedian gets killed, because he discovers this plan to villainize Dr. Manhattan, steal his power to make fossil fuels irrelevant, thereby saving the world from the Cold War, which, you know, clearly was not in the comic, because they had already done the whole electric energy thing and could kind of do a Cold War thing. And that's the other thing about this. You know, why set a movie in 1985 if you can't capture 1985, right? If you can't do the Cold War, I mean, this
well,
thing
because
is...
because of that whole superficial fidelity thing.
So, but in the comic, they have the island of artists who are basically going to all be murdered, which they kind of do in this. They kill all the people who helped with the project.
Right.
But in the comic, it's like much more. You know, it's like I think the guy who wrote and drew the Tales of the Black Freighter was on that island too. And for some reason he wanted all these creative people to come up with the horrifying images that were going to shoot through people's heads. Cause that's, you know, in the movie, it's really simple. They drop essentially clean nukes all over the place and it kills everybody, but the, you know, it's clean so you can rebuild and not lose all of your set. And certainly not the World Trade Center, because, you know, we're making a point here, man.
By the way, I don't even understand how, I mean, in the comic, the comedian gets killed because he just happened to, like, fly over the island where all the artists were. And he even mentions that in his tearful confessional to Moloch. But, how did anyone find out about Ozymandias's alternate movie version plan in the movie version?
I think that the comedian was just upset that he was giving people cancer. That was his tearful scene. That he was just giving them cancer. Well, I mean, it's not clear. It's not a very big scene. I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, they present this as a great mystery, but they don't. There's no mystery about it. They never actually really investigate. They never do anything like that. About all Rorschach ever does is go, you know, beat up Matt Frewer a couple times.
Yeah.
And that brings... I do want to talk about the cast a little, because what I find so funny about it is didn't... What's his face? Jude Law run around saying he'd love to be in This Is Ozymandias for a long time.
Was that him or was that Wizard Magazine?
I think it was him, too. I think he said it too. But instead they get Matthew Good, who's really, really awful in this. And that guy was really good in The Lookout. And so why they got... I mean, he's just terrible in this movie. I mean, he's laughable, just like Malin Ackerman as Silk Spectre 2. And Carla Gugino to some degree. And I mean, Jeffrey Dean Morgan's got a couple...
He's okay. I mean... Wizard Magazine casting would have actually helped. I think they should have gotten Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, I mean, they could have done so much better, and I think that to some degree... that's Zack Snyder. Well, I mean, I think these people are signed to sequels still. I thought that was like the rumor.
For Watchmen? For real?
Well, yeah, I think so. That they were signed to some kind of sequel.
Wow.
It's Warner Brothers. Come on, they care. They're doing this. I forget. I totally forgot about this. I think they're doing this at DC Comics now, because Warner Brothers has taken over DC Comics in a more direct, hands-on approach and changed up the company.
Maybe it'll take place in a post-alternate 9/11 future.
Oh, that'd be an interesting. There you go. Anyway, so. I mean,
yeah, the casting, I mean, yeah, you know, the casting is kind of, that's probably the most surprising thing about it is that, like, yeah, they did get somebody who could pull off Rorschach all right, or pull off the voice right, or whatever. And the funny thing about before this movie came out, I mean, look, isn't every movie now more about the hype and the pre-publicity than it is
the actual
after
content,
the movie comes out. Because I swear to God, people don't even remember that there was a Watchmen movie now. But before the Watchmen movie came out, it was like, oh, who's going to play Rorschach? And then, oh, Jackie Earle Haley. Oh, he was the weird-looking kid in Bad News Bears, what he's been up to. And then you see him in the movie, and it's like, oh, wow, he actually kind of pulls it off there. And now it's like, now he's going to play Freddy Krueger. And he landed Freddy Krueger by doing this movie, but nobody's even talking about, he played Rorschach, all right. I bet he can play Freddy Krueger. They're reacting to the new Freddy Krueger like this is another discovery of who's going to take on this role that's so important to nerds,
I think to some degree some of the casting had to do with who was popular off of... I mean, Jackie Earle Haley just had a... Oscar nomination. Patrick Wilson seemed like he was close to getting one. I think they tried really hard to legitimize the whole thing. And I think that they failed in some ways. Just because it's not...
Patrick Wilson's all right as Night Owl.
He's okay as Night Owl, but at a certain point, the character, he's not... In the comic book, Night Owl looked like Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's not what Patrick Wilson... And that was one of my problems.
He needed to be fatter.
He needed to be fatter and naturally fatter for it to be believable. And that was one of my problems with this movie before I even saw it. You have people in old age makeup that is absurd.
Oh, man, Silk Spectre 1's old age makeup is hideous.
Her old age makeup's hideous. How old is Silk Spectre 2 supposed to be?
She says she's, what, 67?
No, her daughter. How old's her daughter supposed to be?
Oh, I don't know. 30s?
Except the I guess the actress playing her is about 30, but...
Yeah, you know what? I can see her now in my mind's eye. I can remember how she looks in the comic, and yeah, she's absolutely older looking in the comic.
And then there's, the aging on Matthew Good for Ozymandias. What did they give him the gray hair? The aging
he looks exactly the same in present day as he does in all the flashbacks.
It's like back on Star Trek the original series. If you know what I'm talking about, when they made people look older with that terrible old age makeup. Yeah. And Hollis Mason, Stephen McHattie, who I just love. And I think having Stephen McHattie and Matt Frewer in this, two very... I believe they're both... McHattie, I know, is Canadian. Frewer's not. I don't know why I assume he is, but... The movie was filmed in Vancouver, and this is another one of those things that sort of everyone forgot about it. One of the reasons that Snyder was allowed to make this is that he was on 300. He did that whole thing of shooting against digital backdrops.
Yeah.
That's how Watchmen was made. It was shot against digital backdrops. It barely even... It's so stupid you don't even think about it.
Well,
I
think their fake New York kind of looks convincing a certain way, but, maybe not the skylines with all the phony blimps and stuff floating around.
Yeah. Fake
World Trade Center, but, the street scenes are kind of
neat. The street scenes are,
where it's like, oh, this is a convincing looking fake New York.
Yeah, and it was very expensive, and it works like that, but...
It cost $300 million to make this movie.
It did not cost $300 million to make this movie, did it?
Oh, wait a minute. It cost $130 million. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I was looking at the math earlier on IMDb's box office business entry for the movie, and just thinking about how it cost $130 million to make and only made $55 million, or only made $100 million gross USA. So,
traditionally, to get in the black, it does have to make 3 times budget. So that is $300 million.
Yeah, I had hoped it would fail, and I'm glad it failed.
And one of the just look at the DVD cover. It's like some dumbass action movie. That's kind of the thing is. Even, oh God, I hate to say this. The Dark Knight and the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, they adapt a character and take elements of stories, and even if they don't make something original of it in the sense that it's
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
original, they're not adapting.
It's a stupid interpretation, but at least it's an interpretation.
Right. It's like the adventures, you know, when I go to the movie theater to see the adventures of Iron Man, I don't think it's going to be some sort of attempt at adapting the freaking whatever, him getting drunk or whatever in the comics, like the story
Right.
of it. That's what Watchmen is. I mean, regardless of whether or not it's a 12-issue comic book series or a graphic novel, it's a finite story. It's a piece of, you know, it's not a character. It's not a comic book movie
Yeah.
in that sense. You can't do it like that. So
Yeah.
why they would. Literal adaptations are stupid to begin with, but this sort of shows off what happens when you take an attempt at something pretending to be a literal adaptation, literal enough for the people who are mildly familiar with Watchmen. Because I can't believe anyone who actually thinks Watchmen is good thinks this movie is good.
Right.
So, and it's not a very popular comic book. I mean, quite frankly, now it's expensive to buy the original issues. Back when I read it the first time, I got the original issues for 50 cents a piece, and this was 1999.
86
No,
or 99.
1999. Nobody
Wow.
freaking cared about it at that point. Alan Morris comics don't sell for crap. You know why? Because it's such a limited audience. It's people who can read good stuff and read comic books. I mean, you know, that's not that big of an audience, really. I mean, it's they require you to do work. That's not what comic books are about. And so, Zack Snyder is not about making anybody do any work. I realize Roger Ebert didn't get the nuances and implications, but that's kind of like, you know, he should pause it and look for all the visual references because there aren't any nuances in it. It's just, you
Yeah,
know.
he should pause it, you know, in Ozymandias' wall of TVs, scenes and see how many movie clips he can
Yeah,
spot.
he
Like,
should.
oh, there's the Road Warrior. Oh.
Yeah, so it's just, it's good that it did poorly in a way, but it doesn't seem like it's going to matter. It's not going to slow the tide, unfortunately. To some degree, I guess it has. I mean, they've.
Well, it's kind of like, what else can they do? Because, I mean, I knew when they were making this movie that we had reached some kind of milestone, not in terms of artistic achievement, but just in terms of, you know, how many comic books are there that got written up in the New York Times, and how many movie adaptations are there of those left to make? Once you do Watchmen, there's not a heck of a lot left. I mean, I don't know, maybe they'll, you know. Maybe when Christopher Nolan is done with the Batman movies, they'll get around to The Dark Knight Returns, and they'll have it set in the 80s with all the 80s era references, like Ronald Reagan, and you know, everybody who posts on Ain't It Cool News will say, well, thank goodness they're remaining, you know, they're doing a faithful adaptation.
Oh, good grief.
You'll have Mickey
Excuse me.
Rourke as Batman, you know.
Oh, man. That'd be pretty funny. Mickey Rourke is Batman. Actually, by the time that Christopher Nolan gets done with his three, Tim Burton ought to come back and do Dark Knight with Michael Keaton. But anyway,
In 3D.
in 3D. Well, of course, in
Well, wait,
3D.
what the fuck are you talking about? Johnny Depp's gonna play Batman. Thank you very much.
No, he's not. He's going to play Michael Keaton playing Batman. He'll put on Michael Keaton makeup and then play Batman.
Well, as long as it's pale makeup, I guess I'll do it.
Okay, this is totally off topic, but how did they not get Johnny Depp to play Freddy Krueger? It seems like a no-brainer. But anyway, no, I'm like worried about if this had done well, would we have had to, would Zack Snyder have tried to make Mouse? And I'm not the only one who thought of this because I googled it and people are, you know, making, you know, horrifying comments about the idea that, you know, if Watchmen had actually done well, if it had been, because I
Oh
mean,
wow. Or Robert Zemeckis, like, doing the whole
oh, motion
motion
capture.
Yeah.
Oh, with Jim Carrey. Oh, my God. I mean, it just would have been amazing.
With Jim Carrey as Art Spiegelman.
And yeah. Then you would have had free... I mean, it would just would have been terrible. I mean, the things you could have... This failing stopped. I mean...
It's true.
Because when this came out, before this came out, they thought it was, you know, comic book fans were going to turn this into the next Dark Knight.
Yeah.
There was all that crap about how, what a fortune it's going to make, you know, and it opened at $55 million. It bombed. And they knew it did. And so it sort of saved us from...
From motion capture Moss, yeah.
From motion capture Moss and just sort of doomed us to...
Or at least given us a stay of execution.
You know, honestly, if they're going to just start making a yearly superhero movie in 3D and it's just going to suck and I know when it's coming out, that's fine. I don't care. I don't need to see it. You know, it's not like I don't care. I mean, Watchmen, to some degree, it's you have to see the train wreck. You have to see if it lives up to the stupidity suggested in it. But
and then once you've looked into the abyss, you know,
then you have to come.
You can never pretend it doesn't exist.
But then you have to come back about a year later and watch it again with the freaking cartoon inserted. And so that's what we haven't really talked about, this ultimate cut that we watched. Now, when the movie.
I recognize some, at least one scene that was in the director's cut that wasn't in the theatrical cut, which I remember being annoyed that they didn't include, which was the original Night Owl getting brutalized by the samurai gang.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I guess it was like, all right, well, you know, at least they thought to include it originally. But other than that, I couldn't remember a heck of a lot that was added that wasn't, you know, that wasn't just like, you know, bookending stuff of the newspaper vendor and the, you know, young black comic book fan reading Tales of the Black Freighter.
Having the same name. I don't think that was in the comic. I need to mention one other thing before I start ragging on the cartoon. The scene with Dr. Manhattan in Vietnam.
Yeah.
What music were they playing?
They were playing Ride of the Valkyries by Richard Wagner.
Which would have been in, I believe, a reference to Apocalypse Now.
Well, the soundtrack is sort of a whole other thing. I mean, actually, it's not even a whole other thing. All I want to say is that, like, the funny thing about Zack Snyder is that when it came to the soundtrack of this movie, he picked the most obvious choice, literally, for every single scene. Like, the times they are a-changing over the opening titles and... 99 Luft balloons to connote the fact that we're in the 80s and the Cold War is on.
But
and Jimi Hendrix is all around the watchtower at the end when they're going to Ozymandias' hideout. That was great.
But it doesn't make any sense because there wouldn't have been an Apocalypse Now.
It's the pop culture version of
but
history.
But it's a postmodern reference in a. The most mainstream movie in the world, and they don't even get it. It's like, it's farce. It's absurd farce, and they don't even realize that they're doing it. And somebody should slash Zack Snyder's tires for it. But the cartoon. So in the comic, there's this kid reading a comic book, and it's an incomplete story. You get bits and pieces of it intercut with other things. And it really doesn't connect in any way thematically with the overall story. It's about a guy going shit-face crazy, killing his wife, and ending up a violent mercenary. Basically, that sums it up. In the comic... So, it's a comic within a comic. And it gives Moore and Gibbons something else to do because their, you know, pirate comics were in existence through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and I'm not sure how popular they were, but, you know, there were pirate comics, so it's an interesting little idea.
Yeah, comic book circulation before Stan Lee used to number in the 100,000s, and there were all kinds of genres.
And so, by adapting it for the movie, they do this gimmick where it, like, zooms in on the kid reading it, and you see the page, and then the page comes to life with animation that if anybody bought a comic book with that level of illustration, they would return it. And of course, I guess the kid's not reading it, so it doesn't really matter. But or he's not paying for it, so it doesn't really matter. But it's just another sign of him not getting, in some ways, that he's not working in the same medium, and that the constraints of the mediums are different. If he had wanted to do something, why didn't he turn it into a freaking TV thing?
Yeah.
People sitting around watching the show.
Yeah, I think that's what Terry Gilliam proposed back when he was interested in is doing Watchmen as a 12-part miniseries, since the original comic was in 12 parts. You can do an hour on each chapter and actually do some justice.
Oh, no, no. What I mean is, specifically with Tales of the Black Freighter, instead of making it a comic book that changes formats from being something that one reads to a poorly animated cartoon that one watches, why didn't he have, though, if he really felt that he understood why those breaks needed to be in the story, why didn't he have it be like a TV show that you cut to, playing on the screen in a diner?
Because of the, you know, superficial understanding of the themes that, you know, were given consideration without having to give consideration to those themes. This is a comic book about comic books, ergo, there's a comic book within a comic book. Ergo, I gotta, you know, if I'm gonna transition to that, it's gotta be in a comic book. So that we can have one of those samurai thugs say, you know, comic books are for retards. And the irony of that is that at this point they really are. Witness Kick-Ass, which just came out, and which also has horrifying levels of violence for subliterate 14-year-olds.
Yes, and the New York Times really goes far in legitimizing it. It's hilarious. I read their review today. Have you seen it yet?
No, I'm not going to see it. I don't.
I went to go see it the other night.
I don't patronize that kind of stuff.
It's actually, it's incredibly incompetent in terms of scripting because it's, it's like super bad mixed with this other shit. So it would have been funnier if Judd Apatow had produced it, because at least then it would have really been super bad as a superhero movie with a lot of violence. But, it's not as offensive as this, because the only person who seems to think Kick-Ass is a good comic book is the guy who wrote Kick-Ass. So...
I gotcha.
It's not...
And Kick-Ass did have horrifying levels of violence in it.
It did.
Before it was a movie.
Before it was a movie. Right. So, it's a little bit different. And, I mean, there's nothing really comparable to Watchmen, because no one's going to ever give somebody this much money to be... Well, I mean, I'm sure they will. But not for a while. And really, if the blockbuster system becomes what, you know, they're sort of threatening it to be, the yearly tentpole release, it's possible that a director won't... Am I actually arguing here that modern directors shouldn't be given the power that... Yes, I am. I don't think if a director's, you know, medium grade budgeted film is a big success, I don't think that, you know, we really need to have them be rewarded with $130 million to make Watchmen. I mean, really.
No.
Because, honestly, if you read on IMDb in the trivia section, they've got the whole breakdown of who was working on it when, what they were going to do. And at one point, Paul Greengrass was ready to go ahead with it. I don't like Paul Greengrass, but I'll tell you something. His Watchmen, you know, probably would have been better than this one.
Oh, Undoubtedly. And yeah, I wanted to mention that he was the other name being mentioned as a director, aside from Terry Gilliam, much more recently, like in the few years leading up to Zack Snyder doing it when Terry Gilliam was far out of the picture. Yeah, they were saying Paul Greengrass would do it, and, you know, I thought, wow, the guy who made United 93, I mean, I don't know if it's going to be good, but I can't say that I know what to expect. You know? Like, is it going to be a shaky cam documentary style version of Watchmen? How would that work? Essentially, I was expecting, I would be expecting a version that would at least be filmic.
Yes.
And not, you know, directed from storyboards that were traced from the comic because the director has no original thoughts whatsoever, which is what Zack Snyder did.
Yeah. And I mean, they did the same thing with Sin City.
Right. That was the one that kind of started the ridiculous dogma that, you know, if we just copy the panels, it'll be a good adaptation.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, the best scene in Sin City is the one where Tarantino's 3 minutes where he goes, "I'm not doing that." And he just directed a freaking scene.
Yeah.
And so, and I mean, I remember people talking about this with Daredevil. Somebody would bring in a comic one day they were shooting and be like, "Oh, we can do that." Mm. Which is not the same thing as, you know, the fidelity of, you know, to this medium. And the thing is, Watchmen the comic is part of the way the comic works is how the illustrations work. It's, you know, Gibbons did, I think, 9 illustrations a page on standard pages. So that's 9... basically taller than they are short, or taller than they are wide comic panels. The movie was shot in Panavision. That'll never translate the same way. So why are you trying to copy a panel that does not fit for this? The other thing is, if Watchmen's supposed to be a really gritty movie, why the hell did they shoot it Panavision? There was just way too much space. They should have shot it, you know, regular.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah, you know, that makes me think of the, you know, I don't remember if it's a full page illustration or not, but when Rorschach steps into the room where Dr. Manhattan is like 100 feet tall, it's this huge panel, and it's great because, you know, your eyes immediately go to this giant figure, and then they kind of, you know, trail down, and then you see Rorschach standing at the bottom, and you understand the sense of scale. And in the movie, like, the shot starts with Rorschach, and then it pans up to see how big he is, I think. And it's just silly. Yeah.
I don't know. Do you have anything else? I need to apologize to the listeners for our lack of passion about Watchmen.
I don't know. I think we've got a lot of passion in our vitriol, don't we?
We do, except thankfully it was a failure, so...
Oh, right, not even a mixed result.
It's like, who really bought the Ultimate Edition DVD? Really? Anybody who really liked it had already bought... Well, no, it wasn't integrated into the movie, I suppose, but, you know, I mean, people...
Yeah.
They would already spent their money on this, and this was one of those movies where they were just going to sort of... try and cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching on DVDs forever.
There's like 5 different versions of this movie on DVD now.
Yeah, so...
Including the, you know, for those who want to sit down and watch the Tales of the Black Freighter in its entirety, may God have mercy on your soul.
On the other hand, I'd argue that it's almost better than the other thing, just in terms of...
What, the movie?
Well, it's shorter.
Yeah. True. And I can think of a few more things.
Okay.
Let me harp a little bit more on the shallow liberal affectations. I noticed that in the shot where Night Owl 2 and Silk Spectre 2 have stepped out of the alleyway of their murderous rampage, there's a poster for the New Frontiersman, which is the ultra right wing newspaper that Rorschach subscribes to. And the advertisement says, "In your hearts, you know it's right." and then someone has graffitied "wing" onto it. And that wasn't in the comic, but you know, it's in your heart, you know he's right. Was one of the campaign slogans of Barry Goldwater in 1964, but it's not like anybody's gonna get that. Who's seriously looking for details in this movie. But also, I remember this really jumped out at me at the end. Well, the end of the movie is the end of the comic book, which is the New Frontiersman has Rorschach's journal that he's mailed to them just before going to Ozymandias's, and it tells the whole story, of course, and yeah, and his journal ends up in the hands of some copy boy, but in the movie they add this extra dialogue about how well, the editor is going like, you know, the whole world's at peace now. It's like some goddamn hippie commune. And the copy boy's like, well, I heard Ronald Reagan might be running for president in 1988. And the editor's like, a cowboy president? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge at the audience. You know, you get the illusions here. Yeah, I think that was about it. Oh, but also, speaking of just Rorschach in general, I absolutely hated how his... mask became a shifting ink blot. Like, how is that
possible?
How is that possible? And it also ruined one of my favorite things in the original comic books, which is in the issue where he's imprisoned, which they have to truncate into, like, you know, 4 minutes or whatever in the movie. But where he's in prison and being analyzed by this psychiatrist, and Rorschach kind of gets under his skin over time. In the movie, he just gives up on him after one session. But one of Rorschach's flashbacks is about how he got his mask from the dress of Kitty Genovese, which was a famous real-life murder case in New York in the early 1960s, where a woman was murdered screaming and lots of people witnessed it, but no one called for help, and it inspired, you know, national press attention and questions about, you know, what kind of society are we becoming when we just want to look the other way. And that's like that was a brilliant use of a real, you know, stitching something from real life into the fabric of this story in the original comic books, and a really great detail for Rorschach, and that the movie just threw it out, because if you do that then you can't have a cool shifting ink blot mask, which makes no physical sense. And also, one more thing about Rorschach, they also eschewed one of my favorite details about him, which is in his internal monologue. I think in the first issue he's thinking about his dad, I think, and he says, you know, my father says that President Truman was a good man for bombing the Japanese, because by doing that, he kept the war from going on and he kept things from getting worse. And that's this brilliant, ironic foreshadowing for what's going to happen at the end with, you know, a big disaster supposedly uniting world powers. And it's not a perfect analogy, but it's great ironic foreshadowing, and that if they had added that in, it wouldn't have ruined anything. But, you know, I don't know if Ain't It Cool News readers, you know, even know what president bombed the Japanese. So I probably remove that reference right there on the spot.
I think there's one other thing, big difference between the two. As I recall, in the comic, it's sort of confirmed at the end that they're not going to publish his journal. Whereas in the movie, I swear they kind of say, no, we're not going to do that. Like, he tries showing it to his editor.
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Yeah, I think you might be right. It's just that I do remember that the last panel is, like, the copy boy is reaching for the journal, and his boss is saying, like, well, you know, we could run it or we couldn't. I leave it in your hands.
So, yeah, I mean, that's... And it's
at least ambiguous.
The movie doesn't really... make you care enough? Because, you know what? Killing all the people off screen, even though we watch a bunch of people get nuked and turned into skeletons, it's not quite the same thing, because the evil alien space monster sent out horrifying, devastating, torturous imagery to everyone. They didn't just get vaporized.
God, that's right. In the comic book, you see, like, you know, bloody bodies strewn all over the place, and that's the one place where Zack Snyder didn't go for the ultraviolence.
So, it's kind of like, in the movie, it's less important that the truth is revealed, whereas in the comic book, there you want it should be revealed. I mean, like, he did pull the wool over everybody's eyes. It should be revealed what's really happening here.
Yeah, and you know, in the comic, I never quite believe. I mean, I was willing to suspend my disbelief because everything else was so good, but I never quite bought the ending that the United States and Russia would make peace because of the threat of a space monster. But it makes even less sense to have that devastating threat be Dr. Manhattan, because why wouldn't the Russians just say, like, you know, oh, that's your guy turning on you, that's not our problem. In fact, now's a better time than ever to attack, because not only don't you have Dr. Manhattan on your side, but he's turned against you, clearly.
I cannot remember. I swear that the ending of the comic is that the U.S. has to ask Russia for complete and utter help, and so it's sort of like...
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, that isn't there.
So it's more like Russia takes over as, you know, a patron of the entire country, which would make the Russian on all the doors make sense and that kind of thing. I don't know if they do that in the movie. So it's not like it brings about world peace or gives them a common enemy. It's that the U.S. is devastated to the point where they can't do anything but ask Russia for help, kind of like... What is it, the day after tomorrow, Mexico becomes the savior of the world
really?
Or whatever. I think so.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, neither did I, but that's what I heard.
Well, okay then.
So, and I guess according to IMDb, Michael Bay was floated as a director for this in 2003 for a few minutes. And it raises the question that,
how would it have been that much different?
Well, it would have been flashier. And more fun to mock. And it wouldn't have had the same
might have had like Dennis Quaid as Night Owl 2 or something.
Yeah, it wouldn't have had the same sort of
Steve Buscemi as Rorschach.
Fake faithfulness. Bay wouldn't have cared about that.
John Malkovich would have been Dr. Manhattan.
You think so? Will Smith is Dr. Manhattan, man. What are you talking about?
And his son as the kid.
The Karate
the Black
Kid.
Parade.
Oh, right, sorry. But, so, I mean, it's
Jada Pinkett Smith is Silk Spectre, too.
You know, I don't think they could have gotten away with that. Now with comic fans. You got to remember that comic fans...
they're all closet racists.
Comic fans were ready to burn down, you know, whatever over the Fantastic Four movies, so... Don't forget, John Byrne, who wrote and drew the Fantastic Four for many years, his comment on Jessica Alba being Sue Storm was, I think Hispanic women in blonde hair look like whores.
Yeah.
So, yes.
It's a good thing Samuel Jackson is like Sammy Davis Jr. back in the day, and he can just transcend those racial prejudices, you know, with the Archie Bunkers inside every comic book fan. he's in Iron Man 2 as a previously white character.
So, yeah. Anyway, the music's awful. I think there's...
Yeah. Tyler Bates, who I think got his start doing the freaking music for Rob Zombie movies.
Yeah, Zack Snyder's a rebel, man. He's not gonna take anything off anything. And Alex Hayter, who wrote it, and his first screen credit was... That's not his name. What is his name?
I think it's David Hayter and Alex... To say.
You're right. It's Alex Tosei's first movie credit, but David Hayter, who is also an actor who appears as Solid Snake in
Hey, yeah, that's right. He does the voice of the Metal Gear video
There you
games.
go. He is credited with writing the screenplay for X-Men. And I swear, I read at the time that he got that credit by. They did not have a script for X-Men. They had notes from, you know, Joss Whedon and all those other guys who worked on it. And David Hayter got the credit by sitting around and transcribing what they were saying. And they turned that into the WGA. That's just what I heard at the time. I don't know if that's correct, but that someone who was basically a transcriber might have written this movie is kind of interesting.
Gee. Well.
Yeah.
Well, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? Have we given this movie an hour?
Oh yeah, we've given it like an hour and 9 minutes or 14 minutes.
Okay. Well, then I don't think I have anything left to say, except that I'm just kind of astonished, and it's been a real education seeing how quickly this movie has been forgotten after literally years and years of anticipation. And comic superhero fans are just no goddamned good at all, and they don't know what they want, and that's why they're still reading superhero comics.
That actually sums it up very well. On the other hand, I do wish that I don't know. No, I don't really give a. I don't really care. I do wish people would see this and never cast Malin Ackerman or Carla Gugino again. That would be one thing.
She got naked for this movie.
I know! In the world's worst sex scene. I mean, really, it's just incompetent.
Leia Thompson didn't embarrass herself as badly in Howard the Duck in that sex scene.
I mean, it's just terrible. And then there's... Yeah, it's like they had to cast... You know Zack Snyder was like, well, we need her to be naked, because she's naked in the comic book. That's what's important about this scene. And anybody else they were looking at were like, I'm not getting naked in this superhero movie. And so they found him, or her. And
okay.
That was that.
So that does it now, right?
Yeah, I don't see any amusing little... cameos, so whatever.
Okay.
Now next time, on the other hand, we've got some really good stuff to talk about.
Yeah, next week's episode's going to be really fun because we're we're all jumping on the Jackie O'Leary train and we're watching a couple of Nightmare on Elm Street movies in celebration of the upcoming remake with Jackie Earle Haley as Freddy, as previously mentioned. And the bad movie is going to be Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, directed in 1991 by Rachel Talalay, who got the job by sticking around long enough at New Line. And the good one is going to be Wes Craven's return to the series in 1994, a mere 3 years after The Final Nightmare, called Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and it was a postmodern take on Nightmare on Elm Street, just like Watchmen is a postmodern take on superheroes, where it takes place in our world as we know it, but suddenly there's a real Freddy Krueger creeping about, and the real Heather Langenkamp has to stop him, and it's a little silly, but I really like that movie, and I even like Freddy's Dead, even though it's a piece of crap. So it'll be fun to talk about.
Yeah. So anyway, Freddy's Dead, I didn't realize was written by what's his face. I'll talk about it more next week. It's written by Michael DeLuca, who ran New Line for many years. And
yeah.
Also wrote,
he wrote
In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, which is by Carpenter, and I like it, and you don't, but I mean,
and we'll talk about that some more next week.
I mean, it's better than Freddy's dead.
Well, yes, it's better than Freddy's dead. That's not what I was saying. But
okay,
anyway.
Okay. Well, and it was a postmodern horror movie, but not quite as postmodern as A New Nightmare or Scream. But, yeah, there's a lot to talk about with postmodernism and horror and Nightmare on Elm Street and the popularity of a deformed child killer and how that popularity has endured so long that Jackie Earle Haley gets to play him. Anyways, yeah, so don't see Watchmen if you haven't seen it already. And this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. I have been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.